Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Section 1 of American Fairy Tales. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Matthew Rhys. American Fairy Tales by L. Frank Baum. The Box of Robbers. No one intended to leave Martha alone that afternoon, but it happened that everyone was called away for one reason or another. Mrs. McFarland was attending the weekly card party held by the Women's Anti-Gambling League. Sister Nell's young man had called quite unexpectedly to take her for a long drive. Papa was at the office as usual. It was Mary Ann's day out. As for Emmeline, she certainly should have stayed in the house and looked after the little girl, but Emmeline had a restless nature. "Would you mind, miss, if I just crossed the alley to speak a word to Mrs. Carlton's girl?" she asked Martha. "Course not," replied the child. "You'd better lock the back door, though, and take the key, for I shall be upstairs." "Oh, I'll do that, of course, miss," said the delighted maid, and ran away to spend the afternoon with her friend, leaving Martha quite alone in the big house, and locked in into the bargain. The girl read a few pages in her new book, sewed a few stitches in her embroidery, and started to play visiting with her four favorite dolls. Then she remembered that in the attic was a doll's playhouse that hadn't been used for months, so she decided she would dust it and put it in order. Filled with this idea, the girl climbed the winding stairs to the big room under the roof. It was well lighted by three dormer windows, and was warm and pleasant. Around the walls were rows of boxes and trunks, piles of old carpeting, pieces of damaged furniture, bundles of discarded clothing and other odds and ends of more or less value. Every well-regulated house has an attic of this sort, so I need not describe it. The doll's house had been moved, but after a search Martha found it away over in a corner, near the big chimney. She drew it out and noticed that behind it was a black wooden chest, which Uncle Walter had sent over from Italy years and years ago, before Martha was born, in fact. Mama had told her about it one day, how there was no key to it, because Uncle Walter wished it to remain unopened until he returned home, and how this wandering uncle, who was a mighty hunter, had gone into Africa to hunt elephants, and had never been heard from afterwards. The little girl looked at the chest curiously, now that it had by accident attracted her attention. It was quite big, bigger even than Mama's traveling trunk, and was studded all over with tarnished brass-headed nails. It was heavy, too, for when Martha tried to lift one end of it, she found she could not stir it a bit. But there was a place in the side of the cover for a key. She stooped to examine the lock, and saw that it would take a rather big key to open it. Then, as you may suspect, the little girl longed to open Uncle Walter's big box and see what was in it, for we are all curious, and little girls are just as curious as the rest of us. "I don't believe Uncle Walter'll ever come back," she thought. "Papa said once that some elephant must have killed him. If I only had a key!" She stopped and clapped her little hands together gaily, as she remembered a big basket of keys on the shelf in the linen closet. They were of all sorts and sizes. Perhaps one of them would unlock the mysterious chest. She flew down the stairs, found the basket, and returned with it to the attic. Then she sat down before the brass-studded box, and began trying one key after another in the curious old lock. Some were too large, but most were too small. One would go into the lock, but would not turn. Another stuck so fast that she feared for a time that she would never get it out again. But at last, when the basket was almost empty, an oddly shaped ancient brass key slipped easily into the lock. With a cry of joy, Martha turned the key with both hands. Then she heard a sharp click, and the next moment the heavy lid flew up of its own accord. The little girl leaned over the edge of the chest in an instant, and the sight that met her eyes caused her to start back in amazement. Slowly and carefully, a man unpacked himself from the chest, stepped out upon the floor, stretched his limbs, and then took off his hat and bowed politely to the astonished child. He was tall and thin, and his face seemed badly tanned or sunburnt. Then another man emerged from the chest, yawning and rubbing his eyes like a sleepy schoolboy. He was of middle size, and his skin seemed as badly tanned as that of the first. While Martha stared open-mouthed at the remarkable sight, a third man crawled from the chest. He had the same complexion as his fellows, but was short and fat. All three were dressed in a curious manner. They wore short jackets of red velvet, braided with gold, and knee-breeches of sky-blue satin with silver buttons. Over their stockings were laced wide ribbons of red and yellow and blue, while their hats had broad brims with high peaked crowns, from which fluttered yards of bright-colored ribbons. They had big gold rings in their ears and rows of knives and pistols in their belts. Their eyes were black and glittering, and they wore long, fierce mustaches, curling at the ends like a pig's tail.
"My, but you were heavy!" exclaimed the fat one, when he had pulled down his velvet jacket and brushed the dust from his sky-blue breeches. "And you squeezed me all out of shape."
"It was unavoidable, Luigi," responded the thin man lightly. "The lid of the chest pressed me down upon you. Yet I tender you my regrets."
"As for me," said the middle-sized man, carelessly rolling a cigarette and lighting it, "you must acknowledge that I have been your nearest friend for years, so do not be disagreeable."
"You mustn't smoke in the attic," said Martha, recovering herself at the sight of the cigarette. "You might set the house on fire." The middle-sized man, who had not noticed her before, at this speech turned to the girl and bowed. "Since a lady requests it," said he, "I shall abandon my cigarette." And he threw it on the floor and extinguished it with his foot.
"Who are you?" asked Martha, who until now had been too astonished to be frightened.
"Permit us to introduce ourselves," said the thin man, flourishing his hat gracefully. "This is Luigi." The fat man nodded. "And this is Benny." The middle-sized man bowed.
"And I am Victor. We are three bandits, Italian bandits."
"Bandits?" cried Martha, with a look of horror.
"Exactly. Perhaps in all the world there are not three other bandits so terrible and fierce as ourselves," said Victor proudly.
"'Tis so," said the fat man, nodding gravely.
"But it's wicked!" exclaimed Martha.
"Yes, indeed," replied Victor. "We are extremely and tremendously wicked. Perhaps in all the world you could not find three men more wicked than those who now stand before you."
"'Tis so," said the fat man approvingly.
"But you shouldn't be so wicked," said the girl. It's naughty."
Victor cast down his eyes and blushed.
"Naughty?" gasped Benny, with a horrified look.
"'Tis a hard word," said Luigi sadly, and buried his face in his hands.
"I little thought," murmured Victor in a voice broken by emotion, "ever to be so reviled, and by a lady.
Yet perhaps you spoke thoughtlessly. You must consider, miss, that our wickedness has an excuse. For how are we to be bandits, let me ask, unless we are wicked?"
Martha was puzzled and shook her head thoughtfully. Then she remembered something.
"You can't remain bandits any longer," said she, "because you are now in America."
"America?" cried the three together.
"Certainly. You are on Prairie Avenue in Chicago. Uncle Walter sent you here from Italy in this chest."
The bandit seemed greatly bewildered by this announcement. Luigi sat down on an old chair with a broken rocker and wiped his forehead with a yellow silk handkerchief. Benny and Victor fell back upon the chest and looked at her with pale faces and staring eyes. When he had somewhat recovered himself, Victor spoke.
"Your Uncle Walter has greatly wronged us," he said reproachfully. "He has taken us from our beloved Italy, where bandits are highly respected, and brought us to a strange country, where we shall not know whom to rob or how much to ask for a ransom."
"'Tis so," said the fat man, slapping his leg sharply. and we had won such fine reputations in Italy," said Benny, regretfully.
"Perhaps Uncle Walter wanted to reform you," suggested Martha.
"Are there, then, no bandits in Chicago?" asked Victor.
"Well," replied the girl, blushing in her turn, "we do not call them bandits."
"Then what shall we do for a living?" inquired Benny, despairingly.
"A great deal can be done in a big American city," said the child. "My father is a lawyer."
The bandit shuddered. "And my mother's cousin is a police inspector."
"Ah," said Victor, "that is good employment. The police need to be inspected, especially in Italy."
"Everywhere," added Benny.
"Then you could do other things," continued Martha encouragingly. "You could be motormen on trolley cars, or clerks in a department store. Some people even become aldermen to earn a living."
The bandits shook their heads sadly. "We are not fitted for such work," said Victor. "Our business is to rob." Martha tried to think.
"It is rather hard to get positions in the gas office," she said. "But you might become politicians."
"No," cried Benny with sudden fierceness. "We must not abandon our high calling. Bandits we have always been, and bandits we must remain."
"'Tis so," agreed the fat man.
"Even in Chicago there must be people to rob," remarked Victor with cheerfulness. Martha was distressed.
"I think they have all been robbed," she objected.
"Then we can rob the robbers, for we have experience and talent beyond the ordinary," said Benny.
Oh dear," moaned the girl. "Why did Uncle Walter ever send you here in this chest?"
The bandits became interested.
"That is what we should like to know," declared Victor eagerly.
"But no one will ever know, for Uncle Walter was lost while hunting elephants in Africa," she continued with conviction.
"Then we must accept our fate, and rob to the best of our ability," said Victor.
"So long as we are faithful to our beloved profession, we need not be ashamed."
"'Tis so," cried the fat man.
"Brothers, we will begin now. Let us rob the house we are in."
"Good," shouted the others, and sprang to their feet. Benny turned threateningly upon the child.
"Remain here," he commanded. "If you stir one step, your blood will be on your own head." Then he added, in a gentler voice, "Don't be afraid. That's the way all bandits talk to their captives. But of course we wouldn't hurt a young lady under any circumstances."
"Of course not," said Victor.
The fat man drew a big knife from his belt and flourished it about his head.
"S'blood!" he ejaculated fiercely.
"S'bananas!" cried Benny in a terrible voice.
"Confusion to our foes!" hissed Victor.
And then the three bent themselves nearly double and crept stealthily down the stairway with cocked pistols in their hands and glittering knives between their teeth, leaving Martha trembling with fear and too horrified to even cry for help. How long she remained alone in the attic she never knew, but finally she heard the cat-like tread of the returning bandits and saw them coming up the stairs in single file. All bore heavy loads of plunder in their arms, and Luigi was balancing a mince pie on the top of a pile of her mother's best evening dresses. Victor came next with an armful of bric-a-brac, a brass candelabra, and the parlor clock. Benny had the family Bible, the basket of silverware from the sideboard, a copper kettle, and Papa's fur overcoat.
"Oh, joy," said Victor, putting down his load. "It is pleasant to rob once more."
"Oh, ecstasy," said Benny, but he let the kettle drop on his toe and immediately began dancing around in anguish, while he muttered queer words in the Italian language. "We have much wealth," continued Victor, holding the mince pie while Luigi added his spoils to the heap, "and all from one house. This America must be a rich place." With a dagger he then cut himself a piece of the pie and handed the remainder to his comrades, whereupon all three sat upon the floor and consumed the pie while Martha looked on sadly.
"We should have a cave," remarked Benny, "for we must store our plunder in a safe place. Can you tell us of a secret cave?" he asked Martha.
"There's a mammoth cave," she answered, "but it's in Kentucky. You would be obliged to ride on the cars a long time to get there." The three bandits looked thoughtful and munched their pie silently, but the next moment they were startled by the ringing of the electric doorbell, which was heard plainly even in the remote attic.
"What's that?" demanded Victor in a hoarse voice, as the three scrambled to their feet with drawn daggers.
Martha ran to the window and saw it was only the postman, who had dropped a letter in the box and gone away again. but the incident gave her an idea of how to get rid of her troublesome bandits. So she began wringing her hands as if in great distress, and cried out, "It's the police!" The robbers looked at one another with genuine alarm, and Luigi asked, tremblingly, "Are there many of them?"
112, exclaimed Martha, after pretending to count them.
"Then we are lost," declared Benny, "for we could never fight so many and live."
"Are they armed?" inquired Victor, who was shivering as if cold.
"Oh, yes," said she. "They have guns and swords and pistols and axes and—"
"And what?" demanded Luigi.
"And cannons!"
The three wicked ones groaned aloud, and Benny said in a hollow voice, "I hope they will kill us quickly, and not put us to the torture. I have been told these Americans are painted Indians, who are bloodthirsty and terrible."
"'Tis so," gasped the fat man with a shudder.
Suddenly, Martha turned from the window.
"You are my friends, are you not?" she asked.
"We are devoted," answered Victor.
"We adore you," cried Benny.
"We would die for you," added Luigi, thinking he was about to die anyway.
"Then I will save you," said the girl.
"How?" asked the three, with one voice.
"Get back into the chest," she said. "I will then close the lid so they will be unable to find you."
They looked around the room in a dazed and irresolute way, but she exclaimed, "You must be quick. They will soon be here to arrest you." Then Luigi sprang into the chest and lay fat upon the bottom. Benny tumbled in next and packed himself in the backside. Victor followed, after pausing to kiss her hand to the girl in a graceful manner. Then Martha ran up to press down the lid, but could not make it catch.
"You must squeeze down," she said to them.
Luigi groaned. "I am doing my best, miss," said Victor, who was nearest the top, "but although we fitted in very nicely before, the chest now seems rather small for us."
"'Tis so,"
came the muffled voice of the fat man from the bottom.
"I know what takes up the room," said Benny.
"What?" inquired Victor anxiously.
"The pie," returned Benny.
"'Tis so,"
came from the bottom, in faint accents. Then Martha sat upon the lid and pressed it down with all her weight. To her great delight the lock caught, and, springing down, she exerted all her strength and turned the key. This story should teach us not to interfere in matters that do not concern us. For, had Martha refrained from opening Uncle Walter's mysterious chest, she would not have been obliged to carry downstairs all the plunder the robbers had brought into the attic. End of the Box of Robbers. Recording by Matthew Reese, Davenport, Iowa.
Section 2 of American Fairy Tales by L. Frank Baum. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Matthew Reese. The Glass Dog. An accomplished wizard once lived on the top floor of a tenement house, and passed his time in thoughtful study and studious thought. What he didn't know about wizardry was hardly worth knowing, for he possessed all the books and recipes of all the wizards who had lived before him, and, moreover, he had invented several wizardments himself. This admirable person would have been completely happy but for the numerous interruptions to his studies caused by folk who came to consult him about their troubles, in which he was not interested, and by the loud knocks of the iceman, the milkman, the baker's boy, the laundryman, and the peanut woman. He never dealt with any of these people, but they rapped at his door every day to see him about this or that, or to try to sell him their wares. Just when he was most deeply interested in his books, or engaged in watching the bubbling of a cauldron, there would come a knock at his door. And after sending the intruder away, he always found he had lost his train of thought, or ruined his compound. At length, these interruptions aroused his anger, and he decided he must have a dog to keep people away from his door. He didn't know where to find a dog, but in the next room lived a poor glassblower, with whom he had a slight acquaintance. So he went into the man's apartment and asked, "Where can I find a dog?"
"What sort of a dog?" inquired the glassblower.
"A good dog, one that will bark at people and drive them away, one that will be no trouble to keep and won't expect to be fed, one that has no fleas and is neat in his habits, one that will obey me when I speak to him. In short, a good dog," said the wizard. "Such a dog is hard to find," returned the glassblower, who was busy making a blue glass flower pot with a pink glass rosebush in it, having green glass leaves and yellow glass roses. The wizard watched him thoughtfully. "Why cannot you blow me a dog out of glass?" he asked presently. "I can," declared the glass blower, "but it would not bark at people, you know." "Oh, I'll fix that easily enough," replied the other. "If I could not make a glass dog bark, I would be a mighty poor wizard." "Very well. If you can use a glass dog, I'll be pleased to blow one for you. Only you must pay for my work." "Certainly," agreed the wizard. "But I have none of that horrid stuff you call money. You must take some of my wares in exchange." The glassblower considered the matter for a moment. "Could you give me something to cure my rheumatism?" he asked. "Oh, yes, easily." "Then it's a bargain. I'll start the dog at once. What color of glass shall I use?" "Pink is a pretty color," said the wizard, "and it's unusual for a dog, isn't it?" "Very," answered the glassblower, "but it shall be pink." So the wizard went back to his studies, and the glassblower began to make the dog. Next morning he entered the wizard's room with the glass dog under his arm, and set it carefully upon the table. It was a beautiful pink in color, with a fine coat of spun glass, and about its neck was twisted a blue glass ribbon. Its eyes were specks of black glass, and sparkled intelligently, as do many of the glass eyes worn by men. The wizard expressed himself pleased with the glassblower's skill, and at once handed him a small vial. "This will cure your rheumatism," he said. "But the vial is empty," protested the glassblower. "Oh, no, there is one drop of liquid in it," was the wizard's reply. "Will one drop cure my rheumatism?" inquired the glassblower in wonder. "Most certainly. That is a marvelous remedy. The one drop contained in the vial will cure instantly any kind of disease ever known to humanity. Therefore, it is especially good for rheumatism. But guard it well, for it is the only drop of its kind in the world, and I've forgotten the recipe." "Thank you," said the glassblower, and went back to his room. The wizard cast a wizzy spell and mumbled several very learned words in the wizardese language over the glass dog, whereupon the little animal first wagged its tail from side to side, then winked his left eye knowingly, and at last began barking in a most frightful manner. That is, when you stop to consider the noise came from a pink glass dog. There is something almost astonishing in the magic arts of wizards, unless, of course, you know how to do the things yourself, when you are not expected to be surprised at them. The wizard was as delighted as a schoolteacher at the success of his spell, although he was not astonished. Immediately he placed the dog outside his door, where it would bark at anyone who dared knock, and so disturb the studies of its master. The glassblower, on returning to his room, decided not to use the one drop of wizard cure-all just then. "My rheumatism is better today," he reflected, "and I will be wise to save the medicine for a time when I am very ill, when it will be of more service to me." So he placed the vial in his cupboard, and went to work blowing more roses out of glass. Presently, he happened to think the medicine might not keep, so he started to ask the wizard about it. But when he reached the door, the glass dog barked so fiercely that he dared not knock, and returned in great haste to his own room. Indeed, the poor man was quite upset at so unfriendly a reception from the dog he himself had so carefully and skillfully made. The next morning, as he read his newspaper, he noticed an article stating that the beautiful Miss Midas, the richest young lady in town, was very ill, and the doctors had given up hope of her recovery. The glassblower, although miserably poor, hard-working and homely of feature, was a man of ideas. He suddenly recollected his precious medicine, and determined to use it to better advantage than relieving his own ills. He dressed himself in his best clothes, brushed his hair and combed his whiskers, washed his hands and tied his necktie, blackened his hose and sponged his vest, and then put the vial of magic cure-all in his pocket. Next he locked his door, went downstairs, and walked through the streets to the grand mansion where the wealthy Miss Midas resided. The butler opened the door and said, "No soap, no chromos, no vegetable oils, no hair oil, no books, no baking powder. My young lady is dying, and we're well supplied for the funeral." The glassblower was grieved at being taken for a peddler. "My friend," he began, proudly, but the butler interrupted him, saying, "No tombstones either. There's a family graveyard, and the monument's built."
"The graveyard won't be needed, if you will permit me to speak," said the glassblower.
"'No doctors, sir. They've given up my young lady, and she's given up the doctors,' continued the butler calmly. "'I'm no doctor,' returned the glassblower. "'Nor are the others. But what is your errand?' "'I called to cure your young lady by means of a magical compound.' "'Step in, please, and take a seat in the hall. I'll speak to the housekeeper,' said the butler more politely. So he spoke to the housekeeper, and the housekeeper mentioned the matter to the steward, and the steward consulted the chef, and the chef kissed the lady's maid and sent her to see the stranger. Thus are the very wealthy hedged around with ceremony, even when dying. When the lady's maid heard from the glassblower that he had a medicine which would cure her mistress, she said, "'I'm glad you came.' "'But,' said he, "'if I restore your mistress to health, she must marry me.' "'I'll make inquiries, and see if she's willing,' answered the maid, and went at once to consult Miss Midas. The young lady did not hesitate an instant. "'I'd marry any old thing rather than die,' she cried. "'Bring him here at once!' So the glassblower came, poured the magic drop into a little water, gave it to the patient, and the next minute Miss Midas was as well as she had ever been in her life. "'Dear me!' she exclaimed. "'I've an engagement at the Fritters' reception tonight. Bring my pearl-colored silk, Marie, and I will begin my toilet at once. And don't forget to cancel the order for the funeral flowers and your morning gown.' "'But, Miss Midas,' remonstrated the glassblower, who stood by, "'you promised to marry me if I cured you.' "'I know,' said the young lady, "'but we must have time to make proper announcement in the society papers, and have the wedding cards engraved. Call tomorrow, and we'll talk it over.' The glassblower had not impressed her favorably as a husband, and she was glad to find an excuse for getting rid of him for a time. And she did not want to miss the Fritters' reception. Yet the man went home filled with joy, for he thought his stratagem had succeeded, and he was about to marry a rich wife, who would keep him in luxury forever afterward. The first thing he did, on reaching his room, was to smash his glass-blowing tools and throw them out of the window. He then sat down to figure out ways of spending his wife's money. The following day he called upon Miss Midas, who was reading a novel and eating chocolate creams as happily as if she had never been ill in her life. "'Where did you get the magic compound that cured me?' she asked. "'From a learned wizard,' said he, and then, thinking it would interest her, he told how he had made the glass dog for the wizard, and how it barked and kept everybody from bothering him. "'How delightful!' she said. "'I've always wanted a glass dog that could bark.' "'But there is only one in the world,' he answered, "'and it belongs to the wizard.' "'You must buy it for me,' said the lady. "'The wizard cares nothing for money,' replied the glassblower. "'Then you must steal it for me,' she retorted. "'I can never live happily another day unless I have a glass dog that can bark.' The glassblower was much distressed at this, but said he would see what he could do. For a man should always try to please his wife, and Miss Midas had promised to marry him within a week. On his way home he purchased a heavy sack, and when he passed the wizard's door and the pink glass dog ran out to bark at him, he threw the sack over the dog, tied the opening with a piece of twine, and carried him away to his own room. The next day he sent the sack by a messenger boy to Miss Midas, with his compliments, and later in the afternoon he called upon her in person, feeling quite sure he would be received with gratitude for stealing the dog she so greatly desired. But when he came to the door, and the butler opened it, what was his amazement to see the glass dog rush out and begin barking at him furiously. "'Call off your dog!' he shouted in terror. "'I can't, sir,' answered the butler. "'My young lady has ordered the glass dog to bark whenever you call here. You'd better look out, sir,' he added, "'for if it bites you, you may have glassophobia.' This so frightened the poor glassblower that he went away hurriedly, but he stopped at a drugstore and put his last dime in the telephone box so he could talk to Miss Midas without being bitten by the dog. "'Give me Pelf 6742,' he called. "'Hello, what is it?' said a voice. "'I want to speak with Miss Midas,' said the glassblower. Presently a sweet voice said, "'This is Miss Midas. What is it?' "'Why have you treated me so cruelly, and set the glass dog on me?' asked the poor fellow. "'Well, to tell the truth,' said the lady, "'I don't like your looks. Your cheeks are pale and baggy, your hair is coarse and long, your eyes are small and red, your hands are big and rough, and you are bow-legged.' "'But I can't help my looks,' pleaded the glassblower, "'and you really promised to marry me.' "If you are better looking, I'd keep my promise," she returned. "But under the circumstances you are no fit mate for me, and unless you keep away from my mansion, I shall set my glass dog on you." Then she dropped the phone and would have nothing more to say. The miserable glassblower went home with a heart bursting with disappointment, and began tying a rope to the bedpost with which to hang himself. Someone knocked at the door, and, upon opening it, he saw the wizard. "I've lost my dog," he announced. "Have you, indeed?" replied the glassblower, tying a knot in the rope. "Yes, someone has stolen him." "That's too bad," declared the glassblower indifferently. "You must make me another," said the wizard. "But I cannot. I've thrown away my tools." "Then what shall I do?" asked the wizard. "I do not know, unless you offer a reward for the dog." "But I have no money," said the wizard. "Offer some of your compounds, then," suggested the glassblower, who was making a noose in the rope for his head to go through. "The only thing I can spare," replied the wizard thoughtfully, "is a beauty powder." "What?" cried the glassblower, throwing down the rope. "Have you really such a thing?" "Yes, indeed. Whoever takes the powder will become the most beautiful person in the world." "If you will offer that as a reward," said the glassblower eagerly, "I'll try to find the dog for you, for above everything else I long to be beautiful." "But I warn you, the beauty will only be skin deep," said the wizard. "That's all right," replied the happy glassblower. "When I lose my skin I shan't care to remain beautiful." "Then tell me where to find my dog, and you shall have the powder," promised the wizard. So the glassblower went out and pretended to search, and by and by he returned and said, "I've discovered the dog. You will find him in the mansion of Miss Midas." The wizard went at once to see if this were true, and sure enough, the glass dog ran out and began barking at him. Then the wizard spread out his hands and chanted a magic spell, which sent the dog fast asleep, when he picked him up and carried him to his own room, on the top floor of the tenement house. Afterward he carried the beauty powder to the glassblower as a reward, and the fellow immediately swallowed it, and became the most beautiful man in the world. The next time he called upon Miss Midas, there was no dog to bark at him, and when the young lady saw him, she fell in love with his beauty at once. "If only you were a count or a prince," she sighed, "I'd willingly marry you." "But I am a prince," he said, "the prince of dog-blowers." "Ah," said she, "then if you are willing to accept an allowance of $4 a week, I'll order the wedding cards engraved." The man hesitated, but when he thought of the rope hanging from his bedpost, he consented to the terms. So they were married, and the bride was very jealous of her husband's beauty, and led him a dog's life. So he managed to get into debt, and made her miserable in turn. As for the glass dog, the wizard set him barking again by means of his wizardness, and put him outside his door. I suppose he is there yet, and am rather sorry, for I should like to consult the wizard about the moral to this story. End of The Glass Dog. Recording by Matthew Reese, Davenport, Iowa. Section 3 of American Fairy Tales by L. Frank Baum. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Matthew Reese. The Queen of Quok. A king once died, as kings are apt to do, being as liable to shortness of breath as other mortals. It was high time this king abandoned his earth life, for he had lived in a sadly extravagant manner, and his subjects could spare him, without the slightest inconvenience. His father had left him a full treasury, both money and jewels being in abundance. But the foolish king, just deceased, had squandered every penny in riotous living. He had then taxed his subjects until most of them became paupers, and this money vanished in more riotous living. Next he sold all the grand old furniture in the palace, all the silver and gold plate, and bric-a-brac, all the rich carpets and furnishings, and even his own kingly wardrobe, reserving only a soiled and moth-eaten ermine robe to fold over his threadbare raiment. And he spent the money in further riotous living. Don't ask me to explain what riotous living is. I only know from hearsay that it is an excellent way to get rid of money. And so this spendthrift king found it. He now picked all the magnificent jewels from this kingly crown, and from the round ball on the top of his scepter, and sold them and spent the money. Riotous living, of course.
but at last he was at the end of his resources. He couldn't sell the crown itself, because no one but the king had the right to wear it. Neither could he sell the royal palace, because only the king had the right to live there. So, finally, he found himself reduced to a bare palace, containing only a big mahogany bedstead that he slept in, a small stool on which he sat to pull off his shoes, and the moth-eaten ermine robe. In this strait, he was reduced to the necessity of borrowing an occasional dime from his chief counselor, with which to buy a ham sandwich. And the chief counselor hadn't many dimes. One who counseled his king so foolishly was likely to ruin his own prospects as well. So the king, having nothing more to live for, died suddenly and left a 10-year-old son to inherit the dismantled kingdom, the moth-eaten robe, and the jewel-stripped crown. No one envied the child, who had scarcely been thought of until he became king himself. Then he was recognized as a personage of some importance, and the politicians and hangers-on, headed by the chief counselor of the kingdom, held a meeting to determine what could be done for him. These folk had helped the old king to live riotously while his money lasted, and now they were poor and too proud to work. So they tried to think of a plan that would bring more money into the little king's treasury, where it would be handy for them to help themselves. After the meeting was over, the chief counselor came to the young king, who was playing peg-top in the courtyard, and said,
"Your Majesty, we have thought of a way to restore your kingdom to its former power and magnificence."
"All right," replied his Majesty carelessly. "How will you do it?"
"By marrying you to a lady of great wealth," replied the counselor.
"Marrying me?" cried the king. "Why, I am only 10 years old."
"I know. It is to be regretted. But your Majesty will grow older, and the affairs of the kingdom demand that you marry a wife."
"Can't I marry a mother instead?" asked the poor little king, who had lost his mother when a baby.
"Certainly not," declared the counselor. "To marry a mother would be illegal. To marry a wife is right and proper."
"Can't you marry her yourself?" inquired his Majesty, aiming his peg-top at the chief counselor's toe, and laughing to see how he jumped to escape it.
"Let me explain," said the other. "You haven't a penny in the world, but you have a kingdom. There are many rich women who would be glad to give their wealth in exchange for a queen's coronet, even if the king is but a child. So we have decided to advertise that the one who bids the highest shall become the Queen of Quok."
"If I must marry at all," said the king, after a moment's thought, "I prefer to marry Nyana, the armorer's daughter."
"She is too poor," replied the counselor.
"Her teeth are pearls, her eyes are amethysts, and her hair is gold," declared the little king.
"True, your Majesty, but consider that your wife's wealth must be used. How would Nyana look after you have pulled her teeth of pearls, plucked out her amethyst eyes, and shaved her golden head?"
The boy shuddered. "Have your own way," he said despairingly. "Only let the lady be as dainty as possible, and a good playfellow."
"We shall do our best," returned the chief counselor,
and went away to advertise throughout the neighboring kingdoms for a wife for the boy king of Quok. There were so many applicants for the privilege of marrying the little king that it was decided to put him up at auction, in order that the largest possible sum of money should be brought into the kingdom. So, on the day appointed, the ladies gathered at the palace from all the surrounding kingdoms, from Bilkan, Mulgravia, Junkum, and even as far away as the Republic of McVelt. The chief counselor came to the palace early in the morning, and had the king's face washed and his hair combed, and then he padded the inside of the crown with old newspapers to make it small enough to fit his Majesty's head. It was a sorry-looking crown, having many big and little holes in it where the jewels had once been. And it had been neglected and knocked around until it was quite battered and tarnished. Yet, as the counselor said, it was the king's crown, and it was quite proper he should wear it on the solemn occasion of his auction. Like all boys, be they kings or paupers, his Majesty had torn and soiled his one suit of clothes, so that they were hardly presentable, and there was no money to buy new ones. Therefore the counselor wound the old ermine robe around the king, and sat him upon the stool in the middle of the otherwise empty audience chamber. And around him stood all the courtiers and politicians and hangers-on of the kingdom, consisting of such people as were too proud or lazy to work for a living. There was a great number of them, you may be sure, and they made an imposing appearance. Then the doors of the audience chamber were thrown open, and the wealthy ladies who aspired to being Queen of Quok came trooping in. The king looked them over with much anxiety, and decided they were each and all old enough to be his grandmother, and ugly enough to scare away the crows from the royal cornfields, after which he lost interest in them. But the rich ladies never looked at the poor little king squatting upon his stool. They gathered at once about the chief counselor, who acted as auctioneer.
"How much am I offered for the coronet of the Queen of Quok?"
asked the counselor in a loud voice.
"Where is the coronet?"
inquired a fussy lady, who had just buried her 9th husband, and was worth several millions.
"There isn't any coronet at present," explained the chief counselor. "But whoever bids highest will have the right to wear one, and she can then buy it."
"Oh," said the fussy old lady. "I see." Then she added, "I'll bid $14.
$14,000!
Cried a sour-looking woman, who was thin and tall and had wrinkles all over her skin. Like a frosted apple, the king thought. The bidding now became fast and furious, and the poverty-stricken courtiers brightened up as the sum began to mount into the millions.
"He'll bring us a very pretty fortune after all," whispered one to his comrade, "and then we shall have the pleasure of helping him spend it."
The king began to be anxious. All the women who looked at all kind-hearted or pleasant had stopped bidding for lack of money, and the slender old dame with the wrinkles seemed determined to get the coronet at any price, and with it the boy husband. This ancient creature finally became so excited that her wig got crosswise of her head, and her false teeth kept slipping out, which horrified the little king greatly, but she would not give up. At last, the chief counselor ended the auction by crying out,
"Sold to Mary Ann Brodzinski de la Porcus for $3,900,624.16.
And the sour-looking old woman paid the money in cash and on the spot, which proves this is a fairy story. The king was so disturbed at the thought that he must marry this hideous creature that he began to wail and weep, whereupon the woman boxed his ears soundly. But the counselor reproved her for punishing her future husband in public, saying,
"You are not married yet. Wait until tomorrow after the wedding takes place, then you can abuse him as much as you wish. But at present we prefer to have people think this is a love match."
The poor king slept but little that night, so filled was he with terror of his future wife. Nor could he get the idea out of his head that he preferred to marry the armorer's daughter, who was about his own age. He tossed and tumbled around upon his hard bed until the moonlight came in at the window, and lay like a great white sheet upon the bare floor. Finally, in turning over for the 100th time, his hand struck against a secret spring in the headboard of the big mahogany bedstead, and at once, with a sharp click, a panel flew open. The noise caused the king to look up, and, seeing the open panel, he stood upon tiptoe and, reaching within, drew out a folded paper. It had several leaves fastened together like a book, and upon the first page was written, "When the king is in trouble, this leaf he must double, and set it on fire, to obtain his desire." This was not very good poetry, but when the king had spelled it out in the moonlight, he was filled with joy. "There's no doubt about my being in trouble," he exclaimed, "so I'll burn it at once and see what happens." He tore off the leaf and put the rest of the book in its secret hiding place. Then, folding the paper double, he placed it on top of his stool, lighted a match, and set fire to it. It made a horrid smudge for so small a paper, and the king sat on the edge of the bed and watched it eagerly. When the smoke cleared away, he was surprised to see, sitting upon the stool, a round little man who, with folded arms and crossed legs, sat calmly facing the king, and smoking a black briarwood pipe.
"Well, here I am," said he.
"So I see," replied the little king. "But how did you get here?"
"Didn't you burn the paper?" demanded the round man, by way of answer.
"Yes, I did," acknowledged the king.
"Then you are in trouble, and I've come to help you out of it. I'm the slave of the royal bedstead."
"Oh," said the king, "I didn't know there was one."
"Neither did your father, or he would not have been so foolish as to sell everything he had for money. By the way, it's lucky for you he did not sell this bedstead. Now then, what do you want?"
"I'm not sure what I want," replied the king, "but I know what I don't want, and that is the old woman who is going to marry me."
"That's easy enough," said the slave of the royal bedstead. "All you need to do is return her the money she paid the chief counselor, and declare the match off. Don't be afraid. You are the king, and your word is law."
"To be sure," said the Majesty, "but I am in great need of money. How am I going to live if the chief counselor returns to Mary Ann Brzezinski her millions?"
"Phew! That's easy enough,"
again answered the old man, and putting his hand in his pocket, he drew out and tossed to the king an old-fashioned leather purse.
"Keep that with you," said he, "and you will always be rich, for you can take out of the purse as many 25-cent silver pieces as you wish, one at a time. No matter how often you take one out, another will instantly appear in its place within the purse."
"Thank you," said the king gratefully. "You have rendered me a rare favor, for now I shall have money for all my needs, and will not be obliged to marry anyone. Thank you 1,000 times.
"Don't mention it,"
said the other, puffing his pipe slowly, and watching the smoke curl into the moonlight.
"Such things are easy to me. Is that all you want?"
"All I can think of just now," returned the king.
"Then please close that secret panel in the bedstead," said the man. "The other leaves of the book may be of use to you some time."
The boy stood upon the bed as before, and, reaching up, closed the opening so that no one else could discover it. Then he turned to face his visitor, but the slave of the royal bedstead had disappeared.
"I expected that," said his Majesty, "yet I am sorry he did not wait to say good-bye."
With a lightened heart and a sense of great relief, the boy king placed the leathern purse underneath his pillow, and, climbing into bed again, slept soundly until morning. When the sun rose, his Majesty rose also, refreshed and comforted, and the first thing he did was to send for the chief counselor. That mighty personage arrived looking glum and unhappy, but the boy was too full of his own good fortune to notice it. Said he, "I have decided not to marry anyone, for I have just come into a fortune of my own. Therefore, I command you to return to that old woman the money she has paid you for the right to wear the coronet of the Queen of Quok, and make public declaration that the wedding will not take place." Hearing this, the counselor began to tremble, for he saw the young king had decided to reign in earnest, and he looked so guilty that his Majesty inquired,
"Well, what is the matter now?"
"Sire,"
said the wretch, in a shaking voice,
"I cannot return the woman her money, for I have lost it."
"Lost it?" cried the king, in mingled astonishment and anger.
"Even so, your Majesty. On my way home from the auction last night, I stopped at the drugstore to get some potash lozenges for my throat, which was dry and hoarse with so much loud talking, and your Majesty will admit it was through my efforts the woman was induced to pay so great a price. Well, going into the drugstore, I carelessly left the package of money lying on the seat of my carriage, and when I came out again, it was gone. Nor was the thief anywhere to be seen."
"Did you call the police?" asked the king.
"Yes, I called, but they were all on the next block, and although they have promised to search for the robber, I have little hope they will ever find him."
The king sighed. "What shall we do now?" he asked.
"I fear you must marry Mary Ann Brzezinski," said the chief counselor. "Unless, indeed, you order the executioner to cut her head off."
"That would be wrong," declared the king. "The woman must not be harmed, and it is just that we return her money, for I will not marry her under any circumstances."
"Is that private fortune you mentioned large enough to repay her?" asked the counselor.
"Why, yes," said the king thoughtfully, "but it will take some time to do it, and that shall be your task. Call the woman here." The counselor went in search of Mary Ann, who, when she heard she was not to become a queen, but would receive her money back, flew into a violent passion and boxed the chief counselor's ears so viciously that they stung for nearly an hour. But she followed him into the king's audience chamber, where she demanded her money in a loud voice, claiming as well the interest due upon it overnight. "The counselor has lost your money," said the boy king, "but he shall pay you every penny out of my own private purse. I fear, however, you will be obliged to take it in small change."
"That will not matter,"
she cried, scowling upon the counselor, as if she longed to reach his ears again.
"I don't care how small the change is, as long as I get every penny that belongs to me, and the interest. Where is it?"
"Here," answered the king, handing the counselor the leathern purse.
It is all in silver quarters, and they must be taken from the purse one at a time, but there will be plenty to pay your demands and to spare." So, there being no chairs, the counselor sat down upon the floor in one corner, and began counting out silver 25-cent pieces from the purse, one by one. And the old woman sat upon the floor opposite him, and took each piece of money from his hand. It was a large sum, $3,900,624.16, and it takes four times as many 25-cent pieces as it would dollars to make up the amount. The king left them sitting there and went to school, and often thereafter he came to the counselor and interrupted him long enough to get from the purse what money he needed to reign in a proper and dignified manner. This somewhat delayed the counting, but as it was a long job anyway, that did not matter much. The king grew to manhood and married the pretty daughter of the armorer, and they now have two lovely children of their own. Once in a while they go into the big audience chamber of the palace, and let the little ones watch the aged, hoary-headed counselor count out silver 25-cent pieces to a withered old woman, who watched his every movement to see that he does not cheat her. It is a big sum, $3,900,624.16, in 25-cent pieces. But this is how the counselor was punished for being so careless with the woman's money. And this is how Mary Ann Brodzinski de la Porcas was also punished for wishing to marry a 10-year-old king in order that she might wear the coronet of the Queen of Quok. End of The Queen of Quok. Recording by Matthew Reese, Davenport, Iowa.
Section 4 of American Fairy Tales by L. Frank Baum. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Matthew Reese. The Girl Who Owned a Bear. Mama had gone downtown to shop. She had asked Nora to look after Jane Gladys, and Nora promised she would. But it was her afternoon for polishing the silver, so she stayed in the pantry and left Jane Gladys to amuse herself alone in the big sitting-room upstairs. The little girl did not mind being alone, for she was working on her first piece of embroidery, a sofa pillow for Papa's birthday present. So she crept into the big bay window and curled herself up on the broad sill while she bent her brown head over her work. Soon the door opened and closed again, quietly. Jane Gladys thought it was Nora, so she didn't look up until she had taken a couple more stitches on a forget-me-not. Then she raised her eyes and was astonished to find a strange man in the middle of the room, who regarded her earnestly. He was short and fat, and seemed to be breathing heavily from his climb up the stairs. He held a work silk hat in one hand, and underneath his other elbow was tucked a good-sized book. He was dressed in a black suit that looked old and rather shabby, and his head was bald upon the top. "Excuse me," he said, while the child gazed at him in solemn surprise. "Are you Jane Gladys Brown?" "Yes, sir," she answered. "Very good, very good indeed," he remarked, with a queer sort of smile. "I've had quite a hunt to find you, but I've succeeded at last." "How did you get in?" inquired Jane Gladys with a growing distrust of her visitor. "That is a secret," he said mysteriously. This was enough to put the girl on her guard. She looked at the man, and the man looked at her, and both looks were grave and somewhat anxious. "What do you want?" she asked, straightening herself up with a dignified air. "Ah, now we are coming to business," said the man briskly. "I'm going to be quite frank with you. To begin with, your father has abused me in a most ungentlemanly manner." Jane Gladys got off the window-sill and pointed her small finger at the door. "Leave this room immediately," she cried, her voice trembling with indignation. "My papa is the best man in the world. He never abused anybody." "Allow me to explain, please," said the visitor, without paying any attention to her request to go away. "Your father may be very kind to you, for you are his little girl, you know. But when he's downtown in his office, he's inclined to be rather severe, especially on book agents. Now, I called on him the other day and asked him to buy the complete works of Peter Smith. And what do you suppose he did?" She said nothing. "Why," continued the man with growing excitement, "he ordered me from his office and had me put out of the building by the janitor. What do you think of such treatment as that from the best papa in the world, eh?" "I think he was quite right,"
said Jane Gladys.
"Oh, you do? Well," said the man, "I resolved to be revenged for the insult, so as your father is big and strong and a dangerous man, I have decided to be revenged upon his little girl."
Jane Gladys shivered. "What are you going to do?" she asked.
"I'm going to present you with this book," he answered, taking it from under his arm. Then he sat down on the edge of a chair, placed his hat on the rug, and drew a fountain pen from his vest pocket.
"I'll write your name in it," said he. "How do you spell Gladys?"
"G-L-A-D-Y-S," she replied. "Thank you. Now this," he continued, rising and handing her the book with a bow, "is my revenge for your father's treatment of me. Perhaps he'll be sorry he didn't buy the complete works of Peter Smith. Goodbye, my dear." He walked to the door, gave her another bow, and left the room, and Jane Gladys could see that he was laughing to himself, as if very much amused. When the door had closed behind the queer little man, the child sat down in the window again and glanced at the book. It had a red and yellow cover, and the word Thingamajigs was across the front in big letters. Then she opened it, curiously, and saw her name written in black letters upon the first white leaf. "He was a funny little man," she said to herself thoughtfully. She turned the next leaf and saw a big picture of a clown, dressed in green and red and yellow, and having a very white face with three-cornered spots of red on each cheek and over the eyes. While she looked at this, the book trembled in her hands, the leaf crackled and creaked, and suddenly the clown jumped out of it and stood upon the floor beside her, becoming instantly as big as any ordinary clown. After stretching his arms and legs and yawning in a rather impolite manner, he gave a silly chuckle and said, "Well, this is better. You don't know how cramped one gets standing so long upon a page of flat paper." Perhaps you can imagine how startled Jane Gladys was, and how she stared at the clown who had just leapt out of the book. "You didn't expect anything of this sort, did you?" he asked, leering at her in clown fashion. Then he turned around to take a look at the room, and Jane Gladys laughed in spite of her astonishment. "What amuses you?" demanded the clown. "Why, the back of you is all white," cried the girl. "You're only a clown in front of you." "Quite likely," he returned, in an annoyed tone, "the artist made a front view of me. He wasn't expected to make the back of me, for that was against the page of the book." "But it makes you look so funny," said Jane Gladys, laughing until her eyes were moist with tears. The clown looked sulky and sat down upon a chair so she couldn't see his back. "I'm not the only thing in the book," he remarked crossly. This reminded her to turn another page, and she had scarcely noted that it contained the picture of a monkey, when the animal sprang from the book with a great crumpling of paper and landed upon the window seat beside her. "Hee-hee-hee-hee!" chattered the creature, springing to the girl's shoulder and then to the center table. "This is great fun! Now I can be a real monkey instead of a picture of one." "Real monkeys can't talk," said Jane Gladys reprovingly. "How do you know? Have you ever been one yourself?" inquired the animal, and then he laughed loudly, and the clown laughed too, as if he enjoyed the remark. The girl was quite bewildered by this time. She thoughtlessly turned another leaf, and before she had time to look twice, a gray donkey leapt from the book and stumbled from the window seat to the floor with a great clatter. "You're clumsy enough, I'm sure," said the child indignantly, for the beast had nearly upset her.
"Clumsy? And why not?" demanded the donkey with angry voice. "If the fool artist had drawn you out of perspective as he did me, I guess you'd be clumsy yourself."
"What's wrong with you?" asked Jane Gladys.
"My front and rear legs on the left side are nearly 6 inches too short. That's what's the matter. If that artist didn't know how to draw properly, why did he try to make a donkey at all?"
"I don't know," replied the child, seeing an answer was expected.
"I can hardly stand up," grumbled the donkey, "and the least little thing will topple me over."
"Don't mind that," said the monkey, making a spring at the chandelier and swinging from it by his tail until Jane Gladys feared he would knock all the globes off. "The same artist has made my ears as big as that clown's, and everyone knows a monkey hasn't any ears to speak of, much less to draw."
"He should be prosecuted," remarked the clown gloomily. "I haven't any back." Jane Gladys looked from one to the other with a puzzled expression upon her sweet face, and turned another page of the book. Swift as a flash there sprang over her shoulder a tawny, spotted leopard, which landed upon the back of a big leather armchair and turned upon the others with a fierce movement. The monkey climbed to the top of the chandelier and chattered with fright.
The donkey tried to run, and straightway tipped over on his left side. The clown grew paler than ever, but he sat still in his chair and gave a low whistle of surprise. The leopard crouched upon the back of the chair, lashed his tail from side to side, and glared at all of them, by turns, including Jane Gladys.
"Which of us are you going to attack first?" asked the donkey, trying hard to get up on his feet again.
"I can't attack any of you," snarled the leopard. "The artist made my mouth shut, so I haven't any teeth. And he forgot to make my claws. But I'm a frightful-looking creature nevertheless, am I not?"
"Oh, yes," said the clown, indifferently. "I suppose you're frightful-looking enough. But if you have no teeth nor claws, we don't mind your looks at all."
This so annoyed the leopard that he growled horribly, and the monkey laughed at him. Just then the book slipped from the girl's lap, and as she made a movement to catch it, one of the pages near the back opened wide. She caught a glimpse of a fierce grizzly bear looking at her from the page, and quickly threw the book from her. It fell with a crash in the middle of the room, but beside it stood the great grizzly, who had wrenched himself from the page before the book closed.
"Now," cried the leopard from his perch, "you'd better look out for yourselves. You can't laugh at him as you did at me. The bear has both claws and teeth."
"Indeed I have," said the bear in a low, deep, growling voice, "and I know how to use them, too. If you read in that book, you'll find I'm described as a horrible, cruel, and remorseless grizzly, whose only business in life is to eat up little girls, shoes, dresses, ribbons, and all. And then, the author says, I smack my lips and glory in my wickedness."
"That's awful," said the donkey, sitting upon his haunches and shaking his head sadly. "What do you suppose possessed the author to make you so hungry for girls? Do you eat animals also?"
"The author does not mention my eating anything but little girls," replied the bear.
"Very good," remarked the clown, drawing a long breath of relief. "You may begin eating Jane Gladys as soon as you wish. She laughed because I had no back."
"And she laughed because my legs are out of perspective," brayed the donkey.
"But you also deserve to be eaten," screamed the leopard from the back of the leather chair, "for you laughed and poked fun at me because I had no claws nor teeth. Don't you suppose, Mr. Grizzly, you could manage to eat a clown, a donkey, and a monkey after you finish the girl?"
"Perhaps so, and a leopard into the bargain," growled the bear. "It will depend on how hungry I am. But I must begin on the little girl first, because the author says I prefer girls to anything."
Jane Gladys was much frightened on hearing this conversation, and she began to realize what the man meant when he said he gave her the book to be revenged. Surely Papa would be sorry he hadn't bought the complete works of Peter Smith, when he came home and found his little girl eaten up by a grizzly bear, shoes, dress, ribbons, and all. The bear stood up and balanced himself on his rear legs.
"This is the way I look in the book," he said. "Now watch me eat the little girl."
He advanced slowly toward Jane Gladys, and the monkey, the leopard, the donkey, and the clown all stood around in a circle and watched the bear with much interest. But before the grizzly reached her, the child had a sudden thought and cried out, "Stop! You mustn't eat me. It would be wrong."
"Why?"
asked the bear in surprise. "Because I own you. You're my private property," she answered.
"I don't see how you make that out," said the bear in a disappointed tone.
"Why, the book was given to me. My name's on the front leaf. And you belong by rights in the book, so you mustn't dare to eat your owner." The grizzly hesitated.
"Can any of you read?"
he asked.
"I can," said the clown.
"Then see if she speaks the truth. Is her name really in the book?"
The clown picked it up and looked at the name.
"It is," he said. "Jane Gladys Brown, and written quite plainly in big letters."
The bear sighed.
"Then, of course, I can't eat her," he decided. "That author is as disappointing as most authors are."
"But he's not as bad as the artist,"
exclaimed the donkey, who was still trying to stand up straight. "The fault lies with yourselves," said Jane Gladys severely. "Why didn't you stay in the book where you were put?" The animals looked at each other in a foolish way, and the clown blushed under his white paint.
"Really,"
began the bear, and then he stopped short. The doorbell rang loudly.
"It's Mama," cried Jane Gladys, springing to her feet. "She's come home at last. Now, you stupid creatures—"
But she was interrupted by them all making a rush for the book.
There was a swish and a whir and a rustling of leaves, and an instant later the book lay upon the floor, looking just like any other book, while Jane Gladys' strange companions had all disappeared. This story should teach us to think quickly and clearly upon all occasions, for had Jane Gladys not remembered that she owned the bear, he probably would have eaten her before the bell rang. End of The Girl Who Owned a Bear. Recording by Matthew Reese, Davenport, Iowa.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.